Noam Chomsky probably needs no introduction. He is an American linguist, dissident, cognitive scientist, and political activist. He is an institute professor and professor emeritus of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Welcome, Noam Chomsky.
Glad to be with you.
We're talking at a time when a historic uprising is taking place in Egypt and across North Africa, as people there are rising up against autocratic regimes in the region. Regimes, it is important to note, that have been supported by the dominant global superpower, the United States. And what sparked the uprising, in large part, is the increase in economic insecurity stemming from a global economic crisis itself sparked by the collapse of the housing market in the United States. But even more fundamentally, that bubble in the U.S. housing market in the last decade was propping up an economic system in deep trouble already, unable to deliver a standard of living for American households on the order established in the United States in the post-World War II era. From the late 1970s forward, the economic regime promoted memorably by Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, called the TINA model, there is no alternative, to organize the economy around free markets into the benefits of private capital, what around the world has been called the Washington Consensus, or neoliberalism, this economic regime is in clear crisis across the world and in the United States. Is this your sense of things, or is the grip on the global economy by this economic model set for a rebound, like the folks at the American Economic Institute and their public allies declare? Is this going to make a rebound, or is it in a state of serious decline?
Well, first of all, we should be a little bit clear about the facts. The talk about a free market model is almost complete fraud. Ronald Reagan, who's supposed to be the icon, was an exponent of radical state intervention in the market. Now, I don't know if he actually knew what the policies of his administration were. When I say Reagan, I mean the policies of the administration. He may have been watching cowboy movies, but the policies were highly interventionist. Reagan was by far the most protectionist president in post-war U.S. history. He virtually doubled protective barriers in an effort to salvage incompetent U.S. management, which was in danger of being wiped out by superior Japanese production. He bailed out one of the major bank bailouts. He organized a consortium, state corporate consortium, to try to preserve the U.S. Chip industry, Semitech, and over and over intervened radically in fact, maybe the most extreme case was so-called Star Wars Strategic Defense Initiative. Maybe Reagan himself believed what he was saying about it. I don't know. But it was sold to the business community here and incidentally abroad as a state stimulus. A stimulus to expand, to support high-tech industry, very frankly. Actually, his whole huge military budget had pretty much the same function. The military budget is in part, it's to carry out wars, but it's also traditionally just been a cover for providing public funds for high-technology industry and eventual private profit. He's called a fiscal conservative. In fact, he was fiscally totally exactly the opposite. I mean, when he came into office, the U.S. was the world's largest creditor. When he left office, it was the world's largest debtor. A huge debt vastly increased, the deficit increased regularly. Running through the details, the idea that he was a free market exponent is just laughable. And pretty much the same was true of Thatcher. So first of all, we have to put aside the mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, it's true that there was a substantial change in economic policy, state corporate economic policy, in the 70s. It began in the late Carter years. Was expanded by under Thatcher and expanded further under Clinton, even more war under Bush. It was based on two fundamental principles. One is sharp increase in financialization of the economy. At the time, say in the 70s, financial institutions accounted for a small percentage of corporate profits. By the peak, around about 2005, it actually reached 40%, now slightly lower after the crash. Financial institutions have a function in a state capitalist economy like ours. They are supposed to distribute unused resources to useful purposes like investment, say bank accounts into investment. They more or less did that for the years of substantial economic growth. The post-war years, 50s and 60s, were the period of greatest economic growth in U.S. history and also egalitarian growth. It was pretty much the same degree of growth across the spectrum. That some economists sometimes call that the golden age of capitalism, actually state capitalism. There were no fiscal crises because the regulatory mechanisms instituted by the New Deal persisted, and there were constraints on speculation. Currencies were more or less fixed. Other constraints prevented massive speculation. All of that changed in the 70s, started being taken apart. The regulatory apparatus was slowly dismantled, finally, by years in the last decade, almost totally. The limits on financial speculation were quickly burst. That meant huge amounts of capital were used not for productive purposes or not for the traditional purposes of the financial institutions, but to just use money to make more money, contributing nothing to the economy, but leading to huge profits. At the same time, the productive economy, manufacturing, was purposely hollowed out. It's called globalization. It means you transfer production to Mexico, later China, and so on, get much cheaper labor, no environmental constraints, set working people in competition with one another, lowers wages worldwide. That's a kind of a counterpart to the financialization. I mean, for the corporations, that's fine. They make plenty of profit. They just produce abroad. They make more profit. So, for example, Obama just picked the head of General Electric, Jerry Immelt, to be his advisor on jobs, which is another joke. General Electric has about half its workforce overseas, making plenty of profit for the company, but hardly producing jobs for Americans. And that's kind of typical. Now, all of this kind of escalated under Reagan, though it began slightly before. It was combined with a radical increase in inequality. I mean, that much is well known. U.S. inequality is now roughly where it was in the late 20s, peak period. But what's less known is that the inequality largely is accounted for by the extreme of the income distribution. So the top 1% or even a fraction of 1% that have just made stratospheric gains. While throughout this whole period, there's been something close to stagnation in real incomes for the majority of the population. People have gotten by increasing work hours, now considerably higher than Europe, for example, going into deeper and deeper debt, and by asset inflation, like the housing bubble. And, of course, that crashes. And there have been repeated financial crises. I mean, the financial system does have something like a market character to it, free market character to it, which means that it's subject to regular serious crises. There are well-known inefficiencies in market systems. Time to go through them, but they're perfectly well-known.
Right.
And unless you have a serious regulation, they're going to blow up. Well, the regulation was dismantled. Furthermore, perverse incentives were created to maximize the threat. For example, there's actually a government insurance policy for the big banks and investment firms. It's called Too Big to Fail, which means that, say, Goldman Sachs can be confident when it makes it can make very risky transactions, loans, investments, and make a lot of money from them, because if you take a lot of risk, you get a lot of profit. But, of course, when you take a lot of risk, you're sooner or later going to collapse. And the insurance policy says, don't worry, when you collapse, we'll call on the taxpayer to bail you out. It's called Too Big to Fail. And that's increasing. It happened right in front of our eyes in the last couple of years, but it's been happening over and over. The big players, the ones primarily responsible for the crash, like Goldman Sachs, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and so on, AIG, they were just bailed out by taxpayers. Their profits are—they're now bigger and richer than before. Not AIG, but the others. At the same time, economic power shifted to a tiny sector of the population, CEOs, managers of hedge funds, and so on. Along with that comes political power. I mean, the cost of running in a campaign, electoral campaign in the United States has skyrocketed over this period, which means that candidates and political parties are compelled to climb pretty deeply into the pockets of the corporate sector. I mean, the Republicans, overwhelmingly, they don't even try to pretend otherwise. The Democrats, it's a bit more mixed, but essentially the same. That has its results. When you fund candidates, you expect to be paid back. For example, Obama was substantially funded by financial institutions, which preferred him to McCain, and they expect the payback, and they got it. That's the huge bailout of financial institutions. It wasn't just TARP, cheap credit, all sorts of other devices, which enriched them even more than before and are laying the basis for the next crisis. The same holds in other domains. So, for example, tax policy. Traditionally, and still in Europe, tax policy is supposed to be somewhat redistributive. Tax policy and other government programs, they're supposed to sort of tame the rough edges of a semi-market system, which is going to enrich the rich and punish others. And they do, to an extent, but not here, not in the last 30 years. On the contrary, the tax policies and others have been designed so as to increase inequality. All sorts of devices for this, which you could go into, but that's what they do. And that's a natural result of transferring extreme wealth into very few pockets. Well, you know, the effect here we can see. The population is bitter, angry, hostile, disorganized, irrational, lots of hatreds developed, being manipulated, in fact. But focused away from the guilty, even though if you look at polls, everything is hated. The Republicans even more than Democrats. Congress is hated. Corporations, banks are hated, and so on. But the anger is being focused on, with plenty of propaganda, incidentally, focused on illegal immigrants, on teachers, on firefighters who allegedly get pensions that are too high, all total lying, but lies have just become completely normal in this degraded sociocultural system that's developing within this framework. Those are the circumstances that we now live in.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, is a lot more than this, but those are some of the main outlines of it.
Focusing on economics on just two questions and then a third final question, but straight on to economics again. You know, obviously the beneficiaries of the current economic order are prospering, continuing to prosper, but there's a great sense of crisis in the general population. That's acknowledged across the media. This is an economic crisis. So first question about the economy is, do you think that the trajectory of the American economy of the last three and a half decades, do you think that that system could in any way bounce back from the crisis to even create the illusion of prosperity? And I use the word illusion intentionally because they, for more or less, have been able to maintain that for the past few decades. One, in other words, on their terms, do you think they'll be able to respond to this crisis before there's a severe public outcry in the countries of the core? And secondly, what would you think could be ideas, economic ideas, that could be put forward by the left that could animate a revitalized populist left in the United States?
Well, the public has been sort of pacified with, as you say, illusions of some degree of prosperity, but it has been it's been built on sand. As I mentioned, it's built on debt. Debt soared. The current crisis is actually a credit crisis, not just a housing crisis. Debt soared, and that can't go on forever. And it's already leveled off. There is consumer spending now. Consumer spending has picked up a little. But if you look at the detailed analyses of this in the business press, it's mostly spending by the very wealthy or relatively wealthy. So diamonds are shooting up and so on. The majority of the population, it's barely moving because they have no money. They lost their savings in the housing bubble. And that's the second way that the illusion of wealth has been created. Fantasies about home ownership going up indefinitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's kind of astonishing, but it's true that the economists in the federal government, like Greenspan, Bernanke, and the others, just didn't see an $8 trillion housing bubble. In fact, across the economics profession, and this is a real scandal, mm-hmm. very few people saw it. There are a few, like Dean Baker, who was one of the early critics, but very few, to be precise, they saw it, but didn't think it mattered because they were working with a deeply held religious doctrine, namely that markets are efficient. I mean, there's no evidence for that, and they're known not to be efficient, but it was a very convenient doctrine, certainly convenient for concentrated economic power. And so they said, okay, there's a huge increase in prices, in house prices, there is a historical record of about a century. And in the last couple of decades, prices just shot up way beyond GDP for no reason. I mean, there was no supply and demand reason. No economic fundamentals behind it. It was just pure speculation. But somehow the religion about markets, what Joseph Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, once called the religion that markets know best, that was so firmly believed that the professionals couldn't see what was before their eyes, with very few exceptions. But that can't continue. I mean, most of the population has now lost most of their savings. People are going to have to survive on Social Security or what they have in the way of pensions. And that's being threatened. There's a major effort on the part of elite sectors to undermine and destroy the pension system and the Social Security system, again, with all kinds of fabrications. There is a real, I'm going to take, say, the deficit. Mm-hmm. It's a problem. Actually, you can make a good case that there ought to be a deficit in a time of recession, but put that aside. potentially it's a problem. What's the deficit? Well, about half of it is military spending. The U.S. Spends about as much as the rest of the world combined on military. And that's not to protect us. In fact, if you look closely, it's harming us. But that's about half of it, mostly untouchable. What's the other half? Well, mostly it's the dysfunctional healthcare system. The U.S. healthcare system is privatized, mostly unregulated, extremely inefficient, has about a lot of bureaucracy, lots of layer after layer of management, surveillance, cherry picking, all sorts of devices. All of that is extremely expensive. It means that healthcare in the United States costs about twice as much per capita as other industrial societies, which have one or another form of national health care, which is far more efficient. And it has pretty poor outcomes, mortality and so on, by no means near the top. Well, that's a huge burden. Some economists, again, Dean Baker, have calculated that if we had a healthcare system comparable to other societies, which is not a utopian dream, there would be no deficit. In fact, there'd probably be a surplus. But that's untouchable, too. The health reform, whatever its merits, doesn't touch that, barely touches it. It still relies on the highly inefficient privatized system. That's where the problem is. It's not Social Security, which adds nothing to the deficit and is pretty well funded far in advance and could be tweaked to go on indefinitely, and certainly not pensions. I mean, there's now an effort in Congress to permit states to declare bankruptcy. It's true that the states have a real fiscal crisis. If the federal funds had been used to support, to a limited extent they were, but if they had been substantially used to support state budgets instead of rescuing Citigroup and AIG and so on, then that wouldn't be happening. But that didn't meet the demands of the financial institution, so it wasn't done. Now they have a problem. To declare bankruptcy, there's a reason for allowing them to declare bankruptcy. That means they can cancel most of their debt. Now, what that means is that public sector workers, like teachers, police, firefighters, librarians, and so on, they've put a lot of money into their pensions all through their working lives. Well, okay, that can be canceled. So you can cancel debt to working people, but of course you can't cancel debt to major banks and corporations. Now that's holy, that you can't cancel. We've got to rescue them. But yeah, working people, sure, you can cancel debt to them. You can cancel their pensions. That's going to leave them out on a limb. They've lost their houses, which was their main source of wealth. It was a bubble, of course, pretended wealth. There's now an attack on the Social Security system, which many are just going to somehow have to survive on. And there's an attack on pensions, which, contrary to a lot of propaganda, don't pay very much at best. But the rich have to be protected. That's what we call a free market. State has to intervene to protect the very wealthy, but you can slam the poor working people and the middle class in the face. Those are the operative systems. Now, they're not going to, there's nothing being done, barely being done, little band-aids here and there to try to deal with it, and it could lead exactly to what you're describing, massive public protest, which without organization, without labor unions, without left activist organizations, could take a very ugly form. It's happened before. There are, I don't want to press the analogy too far, but it has certain similarities which have been noticed to late Weimar Germany. You focus your anger on vulnerable targets. Immigrants is the obvious one. So focus your anger on immigrants. This is an interesting campaign going on now, a very ugly campaign, to try to focus people's anger on public sector workers,
right.
Teachers, for example. They're the problem. Or, pensions for police forces. That's the problem that's destroying us. Well, you know, that's, of course, it's total fabrication, but it's a familiar device, creating hysteria, you know, and fear in order to try to avert attention from the real issues. If there's no counterattack to that, it could succeed.
Well, how to revitalize that counter response? I mean, clearly, if you look at polls among the general population, a lot of progressive policy positions are actually widely embraced by the population. I think that there is a great consciousness that a society that has 2 million of its people in prison, that health and education, really quality health and education, are really only available to the rich, that there are unpopular imperial wars that are imposed on peoples around the world against their will, that there's broad economic decline with record-setting levels of unemployment and poverty. There's a general consensus that this society could work a lot better for the general population, among the general population, but there's no progressive political movement or just a vision for a more positive, better organized society that has coalesced and can be presented to the American people. So how can you see a left reemerging, reviving itself, given that there's fertile ground because there's such a crisis? How do you see that happening?
It's very fertile ground. In fact, even if you look at people, I mean, there have been, for example, studies of a sample group of people who call themselves opponents of big government. You know, they want to get the federal government off their back, cut back government, and so on. Just that sample. It turns out when you go case by case that they have pretty much what are called social democratic attitudes. More spending for health, more spending for education, more spending to help the poor, but don't call it welfare because that's been demonized by Reaganite fantasies and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But across the board, that's pretty much the case. It was the same with the health program. That was pretty striking. There's now a majority of the population, small majority, who want to repeal the health reform. But if you look at their attitudes, what they're in favor of is things like, say, the public option. Obama gave that up in the face of approximately 2-to-1 support for it. People are, about 85% of the population is opposed to the massive giveaway to pharmaceutical companies. In the United States, I think probably alone, the government is not permitted to negotiate drug prices, so they're out of sight. Overwhelming opposition to that, but that, again, was just given away. And so it goes, case by case. So, yes, you're quite right. The basis is there for a serious left movement, but it has to be organized. I mean, this is not the first time in American history. We can learn some lessons from the past. The current scene, the 1920s, have a certain resemblance to what happened in the last decade, leading up to a comparable crash. And there were a couple of years after the crash was 1929. It was several years before any really concerted, organized popular movement developed to try to overcome the roots of the crisis. But it did. It was spearheaded by the labor movement. The labor movement had been virtually crushed in the 1920s. The United States has a pretty violent labor history, more so than other countries. But it reconstituted, the CIO organizing sit-down strikes, which terrified the business classes because they're just one step short of taking over the factories and running them yourself, and other activism, which did help impel, in fact, substantially impelled the New Deal measures, which did improve things. I'm old enough to remember that. Most of my family was unemployed, working class. It gave a sense of hope, of purposefulness, and so on. A lot of these measures have, as long as they're in place, have been quite effective for the general population. Well, That's one of the reasons why there's such a bitter attack against unions, of course, on the part of business, which always hates them, but also on the part of government, media propaganda, and so on. And that one thing that has to be done, if there's going to be any step forward, is organization of working people. Now, there's a kind of a myth circulated that working people don't want unions. Polls show exactly the opposite. The U.S. is different from other industrial societies, and there's a huge pool of working people who want unions but are blocked because of our labor regulations, and in fact just by even by the refusal of the government since Reagan to implement labor laws. Well, that can be overcome. There is no reason to have a huge bloated financial sector, which is really parasitic on the society. It's not clear that it performs any useful function. It may be mostly harmful. Some leading economists are finally beginning to recognize that. Well, that doesn't have to exist. Those are government-created principles. They're simple ways of dealing with them, which, of course, aren't on the agenda because the financial institutions are too powerful. But one way to deal with the deficit, if you're worried about it, is with a transaction tax, mm-hmm. National transaction tax. It used to be called a Tobin tax, some small tax on short-term transactions, which would cut down very wasteful, socially and economically wasteful, but very profitable, financial manipulations and bring in a ton of money. Well, it is done elsewhere, even in England. But here it can't get onto the agenda. Financial institutions are too powerful. But it could happen. And as far as elimination of the manufacturing system, reduction of the manufacturing system is concerned, that can be overcome. I mean, take, say, green technology, which almost everyone recognizes is going to be a major growth area, quite apart from its significance for doing something about the severe threat of climate change. It's a major growth area. Well, there is investment. Americans do invest in green technology, but in China. They invest in China far, far more than they do here. And China, in fact, is becoming one of the, maybe the world leader in much of green technology. Same is happening in Germany, Spain, and elsewhere. Not here. Here, the investors don't invest because there's no government support for it, no infrastructure, no stimulus, and so on and so forth. In fact, the U.S. is now complaining that China is supporting green technology. I mean, instead of developing it here, what we're doing is charging that they're engaged in unfair trade practices by laying the basis for gaining the lead in much of green technology. In fact, what they're doing is pretty much what the U.S. did in the 1950s and the 60s with regard to the electronics-based industries. They were substantially subsidized by federal spending and federal procurement and other devices, a lot of it through the Pentagon. I mean, that's the IT revolution, you know, computers, the Internet, microelectronics, and the rest of it. Okay, the Chinese are now doing that with green technology. We're not doing it. As far as U.S. investors are concerned, you know, happy to make their money in China. But that doesn't have to be the case. Those are political decisions. In fact, you can go on beyond that. I mean, when Obama pretty much took over a large part of the auto industry, there were many options that could be pursued. One of them was the option that was pursued, namely reconstituted in a way which will be profitable for management when you give it back to them. That's one way. So close plants, ship production to Mexico, and so on. There was another way. Another way would have been to convert it. Instead of closing down a GM plant, convert it to production of, say, high-speed rail, which the U.S. desperately needs. In fact, at the same time plants are being closed here, the transportation secretary was in Spain trying to contract for production of high-speed rail in Spanish companies. Well, you know, those aren't laws of nature. Those are decisions. If the corporations don't want to do it, it's even a better solution. The plants can be taken over by the workforce and run efficiently. There are little bits and pieces of that, but that could be done much more extensively. Could be quite profitable and could be good for the society and the economy. And there's case after case like this. But these things have to be placed on the have to be brought to public consciousness and awareness, and people have to be organized to try to do something about them. Well, those are big tasks, but there aren't any magic keys.
Right.
It has to be done the same way it was done in the past.
Well, there certainly are obstacles to getting a left message out in America, and you ended on a point relevant to the final question I have, which are just any advice you may have from your career of looking at media discourse in the United States and the left across the world in the United States, any advice you might have as to how to overcome the obstacles that exist for organizing a left and getting a left message out in the United States?
I think actually we know the answers. As I said, there are no magic keys. It takes hard work. We know the effectiveness of these measures from our own history. I mentioned a couple of examples. And what's right at this moment, we can see it. I mean, you mentioned what's happening in the Arab world. It's pretty spectacular. In fact, it's the greatest popular uprising that I can remember. It's quite remarkable. These are people who have lived through very long period of repression, brutality, violence, economic destruction, also through neoliberal measures, which, say, in Egypt did raise growth rates and created a sector of extreme wealth, but not the population. They suffered from it, as in most places. Well, they're, to everyone's surprise, rising up under conditions far harsher than any that we face. And it's not magic. It takes work, energy, dedication, commitment, willingness to face the problems that are going to arise, nowhere near as severe here as they are, say, in Egypt. But, you don't get praised and rewarded by the powerful for trying to create a more just society. You don't expect that. But the benefits can be overwhelming. Has to be done, that's all.
And one final question, almost as an addendum. I actually was just wondering what your thoughts are about progressives in terms of economic policy advocating. And, of course, this is probably not tenable given up the makeup of the current Congress and the Obama administration, but advocating for the readoption of New Deal-like Roosevelt public works programs, full employment programs.
Makes very good sense. I mean, there's huge unemployment. I mean, it's much worse than the figures indicate. First of all, because the figures are understated. They don't include the huge number of people who've given up, but also because of the distribution of unemployment. So toward the upper end of the economic spectrum, say top 10% and so on, there isn't very high unemployment. In fact, not much at all. When you go down to the lower part, unemployment is at the level of the Great Depression. And something can be done about that. Public works is one thing that can be done. It's a very straightforward way for the government to create employment. Furthermore, it has a big multiplier effect. If you pay people to, say, rebuild infrastructure, convert factories, weatherize homes, all kinds of things, that puts money into people's pockets. And putting money into the pockets of working people is quite different from putting it into the pockets of extreme wealth, like the Bush tax cuts, because working people spend that money. And when they spend it, that increases demand, it increases production, gives you more jobs. It's called the multiplier effect, which can be substantial. On the other hand, things like the Bush tax cuts, which Obama gave away just a couple of months ago, that has little, if any, effect on developing the economy. So sure, there are things that can be done just like that.
Noam Chomsky, I want to thank you so much for joining us on Building a Powerful Left in the United States.
Glad to talk to you.
Thank you. Take care.